Now we shift gears. This is Mae Brussel, and it's KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California. It's broadcast number 629, December 26, 1983. I will begin with just, well, and we'll talk about what we did last year in one moment. I usually don't have guests here, but there's two fellows out here from Michigan who did that 1984 calendar. You may have seen it in, it's been advertised in Mother Jones and People's World, and it's sold here in the peninsula. We talked about this for a half hour before World Watchers began, so we'll just briefly mention it. Howard Levine and Tim Keefe are here, and they did 2 years' research into the way we lose our freedoms, and on certain dates, what happened. They have it in an interesting order, what happened on December the 1st or December 26th, and going down the line, how our freedom is whittled away. I don't know what more we can say a little bit about this, because this tape is against the regular broadcast, goes out to a different audience. What do you want people to know the most about the calendar when they get it? Let's start with Howard. Just what do you think the goal of this is to get across to people?
I think the goal of it is to let people know exactly how far we've come towards that Big Brother society, how far our freedoms have been eroded, and that if they don't really stand up and do something about it, and everybody really not be afraid to say what's really going on, then things are just going to keep getting worse, and we're really going to end up in some of the deepest problems we can get into.
So you think that they should be able to recognize how things have happened at certain dates, right?
Right, not only how, but also why.
Why? Does it explain? Well, it explains why. Yeah, you have a reason there. Yeah. Tim, what do you feel about it? How do you want this calendar to be? If people buy it, what do you want them to feel about it?
Well, I think that it should be received as Orwell's book was intended, as a warning. I mean, he wrote this book and didn't prophesy necessarily, but said, you know, here's things that possibly could develop and that people should be looking at this. And I guess just to repeat what Howard said, that people ought to seriously be looking at these issues and understand that this is real and that these are real problems. I think that's pretty much the message.
Yeah. Well, they're real. Just before we began World Watchers, I got a call on the first part of this program, the talk show, asking me, how do we know when our freedoms are gone? What are the symptoms? Are we victims? And I think two of the best ways to recognize it are the two things that I've been hitting on the news for the last 4 weeks. We rarely have an occasion to see it so flagrant. One is the invasion of Granada. I've been detailing for you what happened at the mental hospital, the mysterious body count, the secrecy, the first time of a military invasion without the press being there and the president lying overtly. Nobody, no civilian was killed. And then having admission of these extra bodies and the bombing of the mental hospital. And the other one is the taking of Larry Flynt, who begins on the air with talking about the Korean airline and Larry McDonald, and then publishes The Rebel and gets on the radio and talks about how he's going to start a magazine to expose different things. And his intent was one thing. The front page is very clear. He wrote himself. His mind was clear. And within 2 months from the time the one month and a half from the time The Rebel is out, he's in a federal institution in Springfield, Missouri, and his wife and lawyer are there and allegedly can't get in. The family couldn't get in to see him. Nobody can see him. There's a total press blackout except for people that listen to World Watchers. They don't even know where he is. And his intent was to get a magazine out that the researchers and all of us could talk about. And within just 2 months, as I've said on the air over and over again, how many people would have Mitchell Werbel, G. Gordon Liddy, and Gordon Novell, and there's Dick Gregory and Timothy Leary right down in your home and on your payroll when he didn't have these people before. He hadn't had them around. He'd been shot. He knew that they were covering up who shot him. He was protective of who came in. And all of a sudden, the top people, the A-team from the CIA move in. So this is a visible way of handling freedom of the press. You take away the publisher. You know, Jack, as far as the DeLorean tapes go, they're controversial, but Jack Anderson published the same information that was on the DeLorean tapes, and he said he would take the Fifth and wouldn't tell where he got them, and they came from Gordon Novell, who's a suspect in the murder of John Kennedy. So Jack Anderson didn't pay $40,000 a day or go to jail. And who draped Larry Flynt in the flag but Mitchell Werbel, the anti-communist who worked for the CIA intelligence community, who began his federal prosecution charges. So that's a perfect way of taking over an establishment and the owner when it begins to get serious. Now we'll get on to the regular World Watchers program. We begin every week with what happened a year ago tonight. This time last year, the news was the Libyan hit squad. Mr. Gaddafi was going to kill Ronald Reagan, and all this news was fabricated, a big story about coming in to kill Ronald Reagan, which later turned out not to be true. This week, a year later, there's an article in the San Francisco Examiner. The Great Commonwealth Club of California, the elite in San Francisco, had a psychic, Barbara Musalam, M-U-S-A-L-A-M, telling them that Ronald Reagan would just about be assassinated, be close with a bullet again. And then part of her speech to these prestigious Republicans is, we haven't heard the last from Cuban Premier Fidel Castro. He had to pick up his toys and go home, and he's not happy about it. She's referring to Grenada. So she thinks, you know, maybe he'll be next. And then the great psychic says that she sees an assassination attempt on France's leadership. Well, Mitterrand's another socialist. She doesn't see Mr. Marcos in the Philippines. They never get it. Of course, it's a socialist. The next one after that will be Papandreou in Greece. You know, I think I'll go in the psychic business. That's what she's saying. You know, take the socialists off, okay? So a year ago, it was Gaddafi. This year, it's Castro. They've created an incident that makes Castro angry so that you'd believe that any Cuban that comes over would kill him. Last year, I was talking about Fritz Kramer and the computer library search, MoBack, looking for Adolf Hitler's Fritz Kramer, and I'll have more to talk about that tonight regarding the Hitler diaries and the special forces, again, I was talking about, and the Nazi connections, the Kennedy assassination. I put a lot of that into the Rebel article on George de Morenschild, Alan Dulles, Richard Nixon, John McCloy. I didn't have room for Leon Jaworski, the special forces out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina, with the Nazi connections training to kill Kennedy, or Clay Shawn Permendex. I didn't get it all, but we did pretty much. You learn that article, and we'll go on to a lot more. There was some more on the Freedom of Information Act, the material on Otto Alfred von Bolschwing, Eichmann's superior, who lived in California and put Ronald Reagan's secretary as ambassador to Vienna. And von Bolschwing worked with Martin Bormann in Sofia, Bulgaria, had property there in coal mines in Katowice, right near where the Pope came from. His father was Richard Otto Wilhelm Ferdinand, Baron von Bolschwing, with his property there in Bulgaria. So when they try to pin a Bulgarian plot on the Pope, it could be Otto von Bolschwing's Galen network as easily as, and it actually has more to do with that than it has with the leftist Bulgarian government that came into power. One quick thing about Mitchell Werbel Livingston in the Mitchell Livingston Werbel, the obituary of the New York Times was a little different than the San Jose Mercury. It said in 1965 it mentioned his Dominican Republic activity. It said 2 years after that, 1967, he was indicted in a plot against the Castro regime in Cuba. Mitchell Werbel has worked with all the anti-Castro Cubans that were suspect in the murder of John Kennedy, and then he moves into Larry Flynt's home. It says Werbel and his two sons disbanded their munitions trading and manufacturing company after federal agents seized 3,400 machine guns on charges of improper record keeping. Most of his machine guns are silencers, so that would be like 3,400 that you can't even hear or see. Little handgun machine guns he shoots out. He's got a whole arsenal. He's pretty good at that. Well, the general is dead. I learned from somebody on Larry Flynt's staff that he had called three people and said that he was going to be murdered, and they'd take him to a hospital. They went to the hospital and couldn't see him. This is what I was told after the death just this week. It's hard to check it out, but I trust the source, and he seems pretty close to Larry Flynt, and it seems Werbel knew that his time was up. Now, one quick item about Johnny Meyer. I'll do a lot more on him. He was finally sent down by the Beverly Hills Police to be charged on a murder charge. Johnny was the guy that worked for Howard Hughes, worked with Donald Nixon. He was very much part of the Watergate. He worked in Vegas and with the mines. He was an engineer. He is, or was, an engineer. 9 years ago, a man from Israel who worked with Johnny Meyer in Canada was murdered at the Hilton Hotel. Alfred Wayne Netter, he was stabbed. And Netter was an Israeli hero from the War of Independence in Israel, up in Vancouver with a... They were making a video. In fact, they used it at Johnny's trial up there, this miniature video using quartz with the video. And he was forming a company. He was an advisor of the company and getting loans to the video company. And Netter was killed at the Hilton Hotel. And the hitman from Las Vegas, they have his name, Raymond McCrory, did the hit, a contract killer from Vegas. An attorney, Gordon Hazelwood, was indicted. He's not being charged. Another fellow that was involved is not being charged. But Johnny Meyer, after years of fighting this extradition, was brought down to Beverly Hills just this week. And I talked to his attorney this evening. In fact, I recommended a good investigator who I know who's going to help them with this. Johnny worked for the Hughes organization. In 1973, when the Watergate came down, he made the fatal mistake, they're going to pin this murder, they've pinned the murder rap on him, of leaving the Nixon and Reagan with Paul Laxalt, that team, and going to the Democrats to tell George McGovern and the Democrats about B.B. Rebozo and the financial shenanigans of the Watergate scandal, part of the Hughes connections. And when you leave the camp, you better be sure you got an army behind you, because he testified at the Senate hearings on Watergate, this was March and April, about his relationship to the Richard Nixon and B.B. Rebozo, Donald Nixon team, and the funding, the secret funding Rebozo got from Howard Hughes. And the Democrats didn't use it. George McGovern wasn't going to get the election, and Richard Nixon had been reelected. And the team turned against him, and I'm sure it's a vengeance story, I know it is, to get Johnny Meyer, an educated person who does have nefarious relationships. See, that's the problem. I'll do more on Mr. Bueller next week and the Lichtenstein connections. He worked for Howard Hughes at a time that he never spoke to him personally. He was willing to earn a living with these people that were questionable right from the beginning. So when you leave the team, it's really hard to know where truth and fiction leave off, because you have jumped the ship and they own the police state and the powers that be, the investigators and the prosecution. So they could kill Netter, get rid of him. There's also a Nazi, always a Nazi, a German Nazi in this story. But they've asked me not to mention his name on the air for good reason. And we'll bring him up later. But you scratch every surface, and there's a Nazi from Germany working with the same team. But because the trial is just coming down the line, I will wait to mention his name. Now, what I said to his attorney was that the Beverly Hills police and a particular person have been intent on prosecuting Johnny, and what they should really do is ask them on the stand their relationship to Jack Eggers, the chief of police of Beverly Hills, who drugged Howard Hughes before he was shipped to Boston, and Bobby Hall, and the Watergate defendants. See, there's a contradiction in them trying to prosecute Johnny Meyer, because the L.A. police and the Beverly Hills police are synonymous with the Howard Hughes organization, with the Romaine Center and the whole Summa Corporation. So for them to prosecute Johnny is to punish him for exposing the truth before the Senate committee. And I felt that in the first hearings, they should bring up all the relationship of Howard Hughes to the Los Angeles Police Department and the Beverly Hills Police. So I'll be pulling that out for them this week. I wanted him to do this a year ago, but he never believed that he was up at Calgary, Canada, and removed from this scene, that in lots of ways he never believed that they would send him down, so he didn't do his homework. Now he is in the they've taken the Los Angeles Police Department. The index of the Senate hearings, of Watergate hearings, I have the index and I also have the hearings. Johnny Meyer's name comes up many, many times. His role with the Internal Revenue and the Hughes Organization, with Chester Davis, with Donald Nixon, with Edward Nixon, with John Ehrlichman. You can see he was right in the mainstream, and the testimony on the Hughes contribution to B.B. Rebozo, Herbert Kalmbach and F. Donald Nixon's relationship to Johnny Meyer, Rebozo and Johnny Meyer. It gets pretty iffy, and if Rebozo and if Ehrlichman, see, Ehrlichman set up the group that went into Dr. Lewis Fielding's office with the White House plumbers, and the LAPD worked with them with Lewis Tackwood. and Squad 19, so that the very team that is nailing him on this 9-year-old murder charge works with these agencies. And I feel that the best defense is a strong offensive. Go for them, Johnny. And I think that's what he should do, go after them. Now, leading up to the most of the broadcast tonight's going to be on a continuation of the Hitler Diaries, because this is the big story of last year, and I think it'll weave into next year. This is a lot of indication of the people involved should be continuously investigated or exposed. And I'm going to begin that section with an article in the It's a Washington Post. Private FBI file held sensitive information of interest to Herbert J. Edgar Hoover. I don't know how many of you saw it. It was December 12th and December 13th, Washington Post on the files. And briefly, what this article says, and I called the person who wrote the, well, it's about him, he gave an interview, wrote the story in U.S. News World Report. His name is Athan Theo Harris, Theoharis. He's a history professor at Marquette University in Milwaukee. He sent for, he has 7,000 pages of J. Edgar Hoover's files, and he's putting them in Washington, D.C. Maybe you guys, I don't know, I'll look up the name. They're here. I have the address of where you can get microfilms of all these. He's putting them all in microfilm so everyone can have them. And everybody's name will mean something different to other people. What caught me about the first thing in the article was how these files were accumulated on political figures with J. Edgar Hoover and Louis Nichols. Now, Nichols, you remember, was the partner associate. He was J. Edgar Hoover's close buddy. But he worked closely with Lou Rosenstiel of Schenley Liquor, and that's when they brought in Roy Cohn, and those were the whiskey mob connections to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And then, of course, as I wrote in Rebel and refer many times, J. Edgar Hoover worked closely with Hitler's top agents, Mr. Reinhard Heydrich and Ernest Kaltenbrunner. So that they were political, Herbert Hoover put in this J. Edgar Hoover when he was Secretary of Commerce, and this was a political agency right from the start. Now, one of the people they mentioned that they followed was Dwight D. Eisenhower, and of course, when he was in Europe, he had an aide, and he could be away from Mamie and having a good time and fix him up. But he's a perfect person to set up as President of the United States, because you already have the blackmailing on him before he comes in, and he's got his sweethearts, and he's not going to go too far off the line. He can make Alan Dulles Secretary of State and John Foster Dulles the CIA director. Then they have their Nazi network all set up, because this guy is already goofing off and having a sweetheart, and they have the information, and they can bend his ear to behave pretty much the way they want him to behave. Now, interestingly enough, these memos indicate that it was an aide to Senator Joe McCarthy, who approached the FBI with the information of this Miss Summersby and how she was married and lived in New York at the Shoreham Hotel and had her liaisons with him. Well, there is old Joe McCarthy that I wrote about in the article on the 007, the Korean airline, with his links to, he was dead, but the links of John Reese and Louise Reese to Larry McDonald and to Robert Morris. And also in the article in Rebel that I'll be referring to over and over again, the Nazis behind Joe McCarthy. And this was Adolf Hitler's little favorite cutie thing, was the whorehouses and the women, and control all kinds of people, news media and generals and so forth, by who they fix them up with. And also the Howard Hughes organization. That was the other Johnny Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, was the procurer of the women for the defense contracts. So Joe McCarthy, Senator Joe McCarthy, just happens coincidentally to be the guy who's tipping off the FBI on Mrs. Summersby, and he has these two close associates that are close to Adolf Hitler in Germany that made him the senator. And while Eisenhower is in Europe, these lovely liaisons are going on and go way back to the time when they're going to bring him home to be president, and they're letting him party around in Europe and continuing and then having these memos. They kept those on him. They started these files, according to the Freedom of Information Act, in 1941. And there's more locked up. There's 10,000 more pages he couldn't get. But if you go back again, the Rebel, I begin in 1940 to 45 is the first segment. And I'll be referring to that many, many times on broadcast from now on, because it's printed and you can see it. that just a year and a half after Germany invaded Poland and J. Edgar Hoover was close to all the top Nazis and later becomes vice president of Interpol, and SS Karl Wolff is working right there with Alan Dulles during the war, and he's the liaison between Treblinka and Hitler and Himmler. All these people are working together, and just coincidentally, J. Edgar Hoover wants to set up these files, confidential files, on the sex of future presidents like Eisenhower and Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt, and they're keeping the current president just before he passed away. They had Eleanor with a liaison with a man 26 years younger who turned out not to be a lover but a friend, and he had another woman, and these papers show how Franklin confronts her, and there's this big fight. Well, J. Edgar Hoover was nosing around under everybody's bed. And these documents, according to the Washington Post, tell about the role of J. Edgar Hoover. He had a wiretap on somebody, and it was important. He wanted to check out, Franklin Roosevelt wanted to check out the Vichy government, if Herbert Hoover was in touch with the Vichy government during the war. And they asked the fox, you know, guarding the chicken house to look into it, because Herbert Hoover had appointed J. Edgar Hoover, so he was beholden to him. And J. Edgar Hoover was working with the Nazis, and we were supposed to be neutral, but if you go back again to the Rebel article of the role of John McCloy with the Vichy government, or the article in Harper's last year that I did several broadcasts on, John J. McCloy, the future president of Chase Manhattan, who was in Paris from 1930 to 1940 and set up Alan Dulles, who was their attorney over there in Switzerland, the wires said that Herbert Hoover and the government, behind the government, the former president, were in fact working or talking with the Vichy government, and it came over by through a wiretap, and Franklin Roosevelt was concerned that his predecessor was having contact with the enemy when we were supposed to be neutral. And this again goes back to the same team that I've outlined and discussed many times, but comes up this week in the news in a new document. So the rationale given, according to this article, for Roosevelt's investigation was that the relationship between the Vichy government was an unwarranted intrusion into foreign affairs, that they expected us to be neutral, and we weren't, and our former president was, in fact, in touch with those people. Then he has documents on the FBI and their break-ins. Incidentally, you can go to the library and copy the U.S. News World Report, December 19th. Care of this story on some of these documents in the Washington Post, December 12th and 13th. And it tells about blackmailing and controlling political activities, which we know are going on. And I've always said, you know, I used to say the elections were determined or controlled by the bullet and blackmail, but I guess it's the bullet, the bed, and the blackmail. I should have included that right from the start. So this is important because it goes back to 1941. It goes back to Roosevelt's concern that that thief and crook, that Herbert Hoover, was indeed working with the enemy. But, of course, it's the way it was written, the documents, it said they found no evidence, but the person who did the research on these files said you can't get the impression that they were cleared from working with Vichy. It was just that they didn't go into it. So he misused those files, and he used them all the time. And this was a great delight to J. Edgar Hoover, to control people with wiretappings and opening mail and following them, and also influencing political candidates, and that's very important. As I wrote in the Rebel, I have the wild Bill Donovan of the OSS, Alan Dulles, and the Vatican, and it tells about SS Commander Karl Wolff and working with the Gestapo in Italy and with Heinrich Himmler and working with Hermann Goering and also with the powers that be, the Dulles brothers, who are going to set up the future CIA. And later in the article, I go into the role of J. Edgar Hoover and his Nazi connections. So that Franklin Roosevelt was suspicious with good reason. And so the story comes out, you know, piecemeal here and there, about their anxieties, and then another article would confirm it did, in fact, happen. Now, going on to the Hitler diaries, because the same people that were working, SS Karl Wolff is the one who takes Mr. Monkey down to Bolivia to see Klaus Barbie. They're are written up in the Rebel story I did. They're in the FBI reports. The Vichy, the John McCloy Vichy, is not identified in one thing, but the J. Edgar Hoover connections. And he was one of the important, the FBI and Dulles, between the CIA and the FBI, the Nazi connections. But going on to that, to the Hitler diary, and Mr. Wilhelm Mahnke, and again, our Mr. Fritz Kramer, our General Fritz Kramer, I got, thanks to a listener to World Watchers, a copy from Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's a description, a few pages. I have a lot, but I just brought a few. Operations of the 6th Panzer Army. Because now we're going into Mr. Wilhelm Mahnke, the head of the Order of the Death's Head, Hitler's right-hand man of the Lebensdart, and also he shows up with Gerd Heidemann and the top people who are handling the Hitler diaries in 1982 and 83. This was written in 1944 and 45. It came from the Historical Division headquarters of the United States Army. I might say to my guests here, we do an update every program or almost every two programs on General Fritz Kramer, because Adolf Hitler had a top General Fritz Kramer who shows up at the Battle of the Bulge, the Ardennes Offensive, and is released by Joe McCarthy through his top German people that made him a senator. Out of the Malmedy trials, he is released in 1948. But Henry Kissinger has a Fritz Kramer who's his mentor, who put him into office and recruited him in Army intelligence, and he ran the Pentagon as a plans officer from 1948 until a few years ago, and he's now with General Graham of the Defense Intelligence Agency and Ernest Lefevre in a strategic trade office. And I'm trying to identify if they're the same Kramer. If they are, then Hitler's general has run our Pentagon since 1948. I have four guests here who did the calendar, so I just lay that on them why I'm doing Fritz Kramer, or for listeners who don't know it. As a matter of fact, two members of a Washington investigative group, I don't mention the group because I feel something will happen to the men, they'll get tripped on the way home, were at my home going over this for 9 hours. So we're going to get the moment of truth before too long, if in fact Henry Kissinger is the highest level Nazi spy in the United States. So that's what I've been working on. So going leading into the Hitler diary, for those of you who are not familiar with it, and for my guests, we'll go back to the operation of the 6th Panzer Army, written by, now listen to this, the Historical Division of the United States Army, Carlisle, Pennsylvania. The report was written by Fritz Kramer, General Major of the Waffen-SS. The history of the Battle of the Ardennes was written by Hitler's general. Now, I'm not going to read everything about it. I'm just going to mention two names that are in the London Times Hitler diary that we're going into in a moment that lead up to it, because it all ties together. This is what Mr. Kramer is writing. He said, the staff of the 6th Panzer Army was formed October 1944 in Bad Salzuflen, Salzuflen, Westphalia, Westphalia. The personnel was two-thirds officers and enlisted men of the regular army. One-third of the officers and enlisted men were of the Waffen-SS. And we're going into the Waffen-SS because the London Sunday Times says that just that $5 million that Stern paid for the Hitler diary went directly to the Waffen-SS because the old Germans were running out of money, okay? They needed that money. Now, you take John DeLorean was going to take $20 million and by selling cocaine make $60 million. So the old Waffen gets $5 million from Stern, and then they can parlay that into another 20 or 30. Then you take the 30, you make 90. They've been doing this and salting away money and giving us the cocaine for years. So, 1984. Okay, now the consulting general of the Waffen-SS was SS Dietrich, and he was released also by Joe McCarthy. And chief of staff as of 18 November 1945 was Major General of the Waffen, SS Fritz Kramer. And this report by Fritz Kramer on the battle tells about where he was. It says, on November 16th, 1944, and the Battle of the Bulge is in December of this is November, it's December, the next month. In, they're working up from November to December. On November 16th, 1944, on order of the Führer, this is the man who's supposed to be falling apart and dying of all kinds of diseases and St. Vitus dance. On order of the Führer, General Kramer became chief of staff of the 6th Panzer Army and received instructions about the intended Ardennes offensive. Now, he comes in November the 16th, 1944, but Kissinger's Kramer is in the same area under the same tree in November of 44. How many Fritz Kramers, and both of them are on the staff of General Patton after the war? Hitler's Fritz Kramer and the American Fritz Kramer. Okay? He's not a general. He's just going to run our Pentagon. So out of this group, working with Otto Skorzeny, and it describes Otto Skorzeny, and thanks to a World Watcher, we have Wilhelm Mohnke working with General Fritz Kramer and the Waffen-SS. He mentioned Mr. Mohnke here, M-O-H-N-K-E. We'll take a 1-minute break, and then we're going to come back to the second half of this program.